Sugatsia for my friends at Casper. Years of research, hundreds of tests, thousands of iterations. The result? The latest and dreamiest in sleep innovation, including the new mattresses from Casper. Casper has done it again with all new mattresses. Waking up with back pain? Introducing Zone Support, Casper's unique ergonomic system designed to keep your spine aligned when you sleep. There's something brand new called Airscape, engineered foam layers with perforations that help regulate your sleep temperature. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything to build the dream bedroom for every kind of sleeper. I've been sleeping on a Casper mattress for years. I swear by it. Most comfortable mattress I've ever slept on. Anytime they have new innovations, I am in on that. And as always, free shipping and free returns. And now Casper is offering free contactless delivery. And as always, free returns. Go to Casper.com. Use code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. That's code Lebatard for $100 off your mattress order. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms.
So last week, I started a podcast series with Amin El Hassan, in which I was going to approach his local hours with me the same way that I approached David Sampson's, because David Sampson has so many great stories dealing in the front office and part of the ownership group with the Miami Marlins. He had so many great stories. And I was like, I have Amin here at my disposal. And he worked with arguably a more fascinating team. They didn't win a championship, but damned if they weren't close. So last we spoke, we left off with you finally become a video coordinator for the Phoenix Suns. You have made it after your travels through Atlanta and the New York Knicks and Georgia Tech and Arizona State University. You are now at what is the end game. Obviously, the end game is probably general manager for you, right?
No, the end game was never general manager.
It wasn't. So yeah. Right now, you become a video coordinator for the Suns. And are you like, I've made it? Or are you still aggressively trying to climb the NBA corporate ladder?
So for me, it was a huge milestone because I had a salary and I had medical and dental and vision. And to me, that is a threshold that not many people reach, right? This is a threshold that people a long time ago tell you you'll never hit. And so when I hit that, that was a very big deal for me. Obviously, my dream was not to be a career video guy, and those people exist, and, you know, a few of them are pretty well compensated, but again, it's your career video guy. So I didn't want to do that. I saw that as a stepping stone to what I wanted to do, which is work in the front office, and so that's how I used it.
All right, so how does one get more and more influence from that position, video coordinator, within the front office?
So a lot of the stuff, and I appreciate everyone who reached out and really liked the story and asked. I mean, so a lot of people asked for advice, and everything I'm going to say, I'm going to preface it was a different time, right? It's a different time in terms of the league in general, and then it's a different time in the sense that every team is different. So I remember when I was in Phoenix, we used to like be jealous that Houston had an army of interns. Analytics, we got 5 interns doing that. Video, we got 3 interns working on that. Houston had a video intern, one of whom all he did was work with the coaching staff. Hey, I need Charlotte's last game. Got it for you, coach. Then they had another video intern whose whole job was all the college games. Hey, can you get me so-and-so's last game against Duke? Got it, Mr. General Manager, whatever. Then they had another intern whose whole job was just to cut our own video. Not even like Charlotte's last game. Give me our last game, all the post-ups from the third quarter, right? And then the actual video coordinators got to like spend time actually video coordinating as opposed to a lot of the kind of menial or data entry or stuff job like that. Phoenix was not like that. The lack of funds was a problem on one hand because everything was a no, or like you'd have to get put through the ringer just to ask for basic things.
Well, let's hit the pause button right there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you own a professional sports franchise, mm-hmm. you're mega rich, especially compared to the average American.
Yes, absolutely.
But there are cash poor owners, mm-hmm. the more family business style franchises like the Chicago Bulls, and Phoenix was one of these franchises that they weren't ever going to dip into a luxury tax and pay a hefty luxury tax bill, right?
We pay luxury tax. That was our thing was, so a couple things. One, nowadays in the NBA, if you are reasonably fiscally responsible, you're not going out of control like deep in luxury tax, you're going to make money just because the way the revenue sharing is now and the way it's set up. And obviously the cap, being lower in terms of percentage. Back then it's like you had to be Donald Sterling-esque to make money in terms of I'm not spending any money anywhere or whatever. So for Robert Sarver, who had just become the owner of the team, it was very easy for him to say, I'm committed to winning. We'll pay the luxury tax. But then you say, hey, I need a server, for these, and it's like, 100,000? What are we made of money? Like, that's a percentage of a small percentage of the worst player on the team, right?
Why is that? Because of optics? What it buys you with the fan base? What it buys you in league circles? Mm-hmm. Paying such a hefty luxury tax and then going item by item and saying, I can't afford this $75,000 server?
I think what it comes down to is part of it is like the optics of like, well, how can you say we're cheap when we are like one of the top 10 spenders in the league? And part of it is like, I just don't think he believes any of that stuff mattered. He thinks like, what does it matter? If we've got a good team, investment in scouting, investment in infrastructure, all those things don't matter. That's not because he's looking at basketball like people showing up to a pickup game. Mm-hmm. And we're telling you like, no, like these San Antonio, these people are all investing an amazing amount of resources into how they do basketball operations.
So your front office setup is Mike D'Antoni is actually the general manager mm-hmm. of this team, which gives you an idea of how much Robert Sarver and the organization really valued this. So you get in with this front office and Mike D'Antoni is basically just tell me what to do all the work and I'll make the final decision. Mm-hmm. Is there sort of a growing sentiment within the organization to maybe change this dynamic a little bit, bring new ideas to the table? And just so the audience knows, Mike D'Antoni's there. Where are the Phoenix Suns in terms of conference seeding? Like, where are they positioned as a franchise at this point?
One of the best teams in the NBA. Our media guide that year and our whole marketing campaign was called Eyes on the Prize. And they had like an actor who wore like this foam Larry O'Brien outfit. And it was like he's real estate shopping. He's like, I really want to go to Phoenix.
What's a team?
It's Steve Nash coming off of two MVPs. It's Amari Stoudemire coming off an injured season, but he would be first team all NBA that year. It's Rajah Bell, all defense. It's Sean Marion. It's James Jones, Boris Diaw, Leandro Barbosa. And then it's like a cliff. And then it's like a bunch of guys who don't play, but you absolutely have heard of Jalen Rose, Sean Marks, Eric Pytkowski, just a fun name, but you know, Pike was great. We didn't have any rookies that year, I don't think. Yeah. So it was a very top heavy veteran team. We didn't have hardly any young guys on the team. Kurt Thomas was on that team as well. And the idea is Suns are going to win a championship.
Yeah. One of the three favorites in the Western Conference. To win a championship. Let's talk a little bit about how they got to that position because the Phoenix Suns are a bit of a fun franchise because they were never shy historically about wheeling and dealing. Obviously, Nash was a player that had a couple of stints with the Phoenix Suns. How was this team built? And we can go a little bit later on in the timeline as to when you start deciding we fell short here in this quest, what pieces we need to bring up. How was this team built prior to you getting there?
So prior to I was there, obviously it was Marbury, Barbosa was drafted, Stoudemire was drafted, Sean Marion was drafted. Joe Johnson was a trade during his rookie year. Like they drafted in Boston and they gave up on him within a year.
I forgot Boston made it to the conference finals that year. I learned that Paul Pierce was actually disappointing and underwhelming even prior to Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen joining. They actually made it to the conference finals.
There's two ways to look at that. There's a lot of ways that Paul Pierce was actually a really great player before mm-hmm. he teamed up with two other great players. But anyway, so that team was there and they had gone to the playoffs and everyone's kind of excited. And then the next year kind of all fell apart because Marbury was hurt and because, you know, they just underwhelmed. So Marbury gets traded ostensibly for cap space. Frank Johnson, who's a coach, got fired. Mike D'Antoni gets hired midway through season and he starts kind of like opening things up, but the team isn't good. They go into that offseason 2004. Robert wants to sign Kobe. Everyone else is like, we can take that money and do a lot more than just signing one dude that nobody likes to play with.
Wait a second. Hold on. Robert wants to sign Kobe Bryant, and he's met with a bunch of people in the front office that he pays saying, let's not do this.
No, no. They went and tried, and obviously they failed because
okay,
like, right?
Because that's how you win in basketball, by getting the big superstar. But you mentioned nobody wanted to play with Kobe Bryant, so there was voices within that organization saying there's smarter ways to spend this money than just signing Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, because there would have been a max for the entire money, or we can take this money and sign Steve Nash and sign Quentin Richardson and sign Stephen Hunter. And those three, you know, one dude turned out to be MVP, and the other two dudes, the other dude led the league in threes, and the third dude was a very productive big within Mike's system.
Yeah. Stephen Hunter actually had some key contributions there, so that's not a plan B. So really, the two MVPs and the entire offense that Mike D'Antoni ran that was so heavily reliant on Steve Nash, that was plan B, actually. Plan A was Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, plan A was Kobe Bryant. Yeah, and so they did that. Now, this is the start of Robert, like, saying, why do we need this? Why do we need that? So they had the number 9 pick, and Robert, because he wanted to sign Kobe, was like, trade the pick, because he wanted the cap space.
Cap space.
And so they traded the pick. The pick was Lou Alding, I want to say. And or it was a 7 pick. It was Lou Alding, and the front office was torn between, if they had kept the pick, between Deng and Andre Iguodala, and ended up being Deng because that's who Chicago wanted, because they struck the deal. So it's like there's a version of this where the Suns are even better, where like Iguodala is like a rookie on that team that has all these other multi-talented people. So anyway, so fast forward to, obviously they win 62 games that year. Then the next year, everybody gets hurt. Joe Johnson wants a lot of money. I don't know if you want the Joe Johnson story. I feel like everyone's heard it already. Joe Johnson wanted like $50 million before the year started, and Robert said, we'll go up to 47, and that's it. over a 6-year deal. And then he plays, and at the end of that year, he's worth $70 million, which is max. So that's when they trade Joe Johnson to Atlanta for Boris Diaw and 2 first-round picks.
Another win-win trade for, I think, the undisputed king of win-win trades in the NBA. It's weird. You go throughout their franchise history, it always ends up working out for both teams.
Yeah, and so Boris Diaw was a guy, by the way, when I was in New York, I put together all these packages that we needed to trade for him, and he was underutilized because, like, he's such a great passer, and Marbury was a scoring guard. Marbury's in New York at this point. I'm like, we need more passers. We don't have enough guys who pass. The only guy who passes is our best scorer. And so I put this whole, I'll never forget it. And it was just like, yeah, whatever, kid. Like, because it's New York. Nobody cares.
So you put that together while you were in New York as to why you needed to target Boris Diaw, and you get to Phoenix.
And he's already there.
And he's already there. So this is cool. Talk a little bit about the system that Mike D'Antoni implemented, and how is your guys' job to go out and seek pieces to effectively use the system?
Right. So it was very much like what you see today in this whole pace and space stuff. That was Mike's thing. Like the 7 seconds or less thing was kind of more of a guideline rather than an actual like hard and fast rule that we have to go out there and you know, shoot within 7 seconds. It's just two things. One is that we don't walk the ball up. And two, when we're in our offensive sets, everything is up tempo. So if I pass the ball and I cut that way, I'm not going to, a lot of times NBA players will pass and then they'll lazily cut that way. We kind of light jog / sprint through our cuts, right? And the idea is that even within a half court set, the defense is working. It's like, he's going this way. What do I do? You know, as opposed to when you walk things up, it makes.
How did that go over with the players? Because that's harder work for them. From a conditioning standpoint, do you guys change sort of your off-season conditioning regimen to be a little bit more heavily reliant on cardio?
Yeah, so they did that first. I wasn't here for that, but the first training camp they did was up in Flagstaff, which is an elevation, and a lot of running, a lot of, we're going to be the best conditioned team, which I feel like every coach says at every training camp. But for us, it was very simple. It's like, if we run, we get more possessions. If we get more possessions, everybody gets more shots. If you get more shots, you average more points. You get more points, your next deal is going to be a lot bigger. Right? It was, the whole thing was like, the faster tempo we can do this, the more opportunities everybody's going to get. And Mike would even say things like, yo, you might run down the court 4 times in a row and not touch the ball. Don't get discouraged. Don't stop running, because the next 4 times you might end up with a shot each time. And, you know, that was the important thing, I think, to bigs, right? Because you're asking them to run and create the gravity that sucks the defense in. but also like shooters like Quentin Richardson. It was important to like let Q know you have to run to that corner, not because you're a decoy, but because there's going to come like a long stretch of time where like every time Q's open, yeah, and you get to tee off.
I mean, Q is the type of player that could have been a more focal point of an offense on a worse team. That team actually had a lot of guys that would be a focal point of the offense if they were on other teams at the time. Amari, Sean Marion, even potentially. So how hard is, because hearing you say how Mike D'Antoni would sell this, it actually made me think about how difficult Mike D'Antoni's job is now.
Yeah.
Because that's not really the same sell job when you have an offensive vacuum like James Harden.
Yeah. And the difference is the straw that stirred our drink was Steve, and everybody knew, like when you played with Steve Nash, you knew this is the greatest pass I've ever received in my life. I didn't even realize that passes came in this quality, right? Like fast, but not a bullet, like nice and soft when I get here in my numbers, not up here, not down by my ankles, whatever. Like, and then most importantly, people would say, I get the ball from Steve and I'd be open and didn't even know it. Steve knew it.
And so he pass you open like a great quarterback.
Exactly. So if you're a player in this system, it's like, hell yeah, let him have the ball the whole time. Because I know it greatly increases my chances to get an easy bucket, not just score, but an easy bucket. Whereas Harden, even though he is a very good passer, you know what his first priority is. So there's a lot of times where you're just waiting to see if this dude gonna shoot or not. And that can be taxing to players.
Well, let's do a bit of myth busting, because I remember the book on Phoenix was they'd score a lot, but these guys don't play defense, because people just, even back then, this wasn't even that long ago, would look at the box score. Mm-hmm. And you guys were really ahead of the curve on, no, look at points per 100 possession. Was Phoenix a good defensive basketball team, a middle of the pack defensive basketball team, or a bad defensive basketball team, as many of the talking heads in the media at the time were spouting on television?
I think it starts, well, first of all, we were one of the teams that helped introduce the concept of points per 100 possessions, right? Because people would say these things, right? Like, the only reason we score is because we play fast. Like, no, if you look per possession, we are more efficient with our offense than almost every other team in the league. Defensively, I would have said that, you know, in that heyday, we were middle of the pack. I know the year that, of the hip check, we were either like 14th or 13th or something like that. The one year we were legitimately bad was 05-06, and that was the injury year. But we still went to the conference finals, because guess what? Net rating is a greater predictor for success than just your defensive rating. Like, because, which makes sense if you think about it. It's like, what's the name of the game? It's like, I want to outscore my opponents by as much as possible. All right. So does it matter if I have the worst defense in the league, right? Let's say I give up 110 points per game or per 100 possessions, but I'm scoring 150. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll sit here and really nitpick about my defense. Like,
right.
So
you guys sort of found a way to compensate for the defensive deficiencies.
Right.
Because Steve Nash, one of the greatest point guards of all time, arguably the greatest shooter at his position, but defense, not really his calling card, to put it politely. But you had guys like Sean Marion and Rajah Bell, who you can just man mark and say, you got Kobe tonight. And there would be a problem.
And James Johnson and, James Jones and, but Boris was good defensively when he wanted to be. And so, like, we had defensive players, but our two biggest faces, Steve and Amari, were legitimately one of the worst at their positions defensively. And so everything was made to kind of mask that or like subsidize that.
So plan B ends up working out for the Phoenix Suns. They don't get Kobe, but they get two-time MVPs, Steve Nash, and some really good core players. Is it at this point that Robert Sarver starts listening more and more to his front office? No? Does that point ever happen?
Yeah, after everybody left, he started the next front office. He started listening to them, and they were bad. And so it kind of like reinforced for him, like, oh, see, this is why I shouldn't listen. See, I listened to these guys, and they ruined it. But that was the next front office. For us, that's kind of how Steve Kerr came about. Because at the time, Steve Kerr was a minority owner, but he was just calling TNT games and living in San Diego, being a dad and all that. And he would come in from time to time, and we knew that everything we told Robert, we want to do this, he would go and talk to Steve. Hey, Steve, what do you think about this? Because Robert doesn't know anything. He just knows what the people he quote-unquote trusts tell him. And so our thing was like, yo, Steve. Like, I think it's funny. A lot of people looked at it like, this Steve Kerr guy, who do they think he is? we were the opposite. Like, yo, Steve, come work here, man. Like, come be the general manager. And that way we can cut out the runaround. Like, yeah. We'll just, cause Steve is like, yeah, that's a great idea. Every time he was pretty much lockstep with a lot of stuff we want to do. So it's like, you were here. We wouldn't have to have this whole middleman and wait for him to go back. Like, we could just get stuff done immediately.
I remember the reaction to Steve Kerr being named general manager, and people were sort of laughing at it. It's like, oh, this is just Robert Sarver has an errand boy in there and he's just a puppet. But actually worked the other way around, where those within the organization were really excited about having someone that directly has Robert Sarver's ear, that Robert Sarver actually trusts. You guys had a pretty impressive collective brain trust.
Well, that's, and Mike, do you remember when we talked about the Browns and you said, and we were talking about, if you're a head coach right now, would you want the Browns job or the Packers job at the time? And I said, mm-hmm. Packers all day. And you're like, what? We got this. And you listed all that. I said, it doesn't matter because you have ownership that's going to ruin it one way or another. If you don't have a good organization, a strong organization, all that talent doesn't mean anything. I'm not saying the Packers were, but we all know the Browns are just ridiculous, right? So it was the same thing. It's like, you know, we knew that we had a good team. And we had good minds in here, and we knew Steve was a smart guy. But most important, the most important thing when you're running an organization is you got to be able to manage up. You don't manage your owner. It doesn't matter how smart you are, Sam Hinkie. I don't give a damn if you literally have the secret to everlasting life in your office. If you don't manage upwards, you won't have the opportunity to do any of that stuff. And Steve, to us at the time, represented an ability. Okay, now we can manage up.
All right. So how does this season go for Phoenix? Your first full-time season in this established position. You have title hopes. Eyes on the Prize is the whole marketing campaign and real slogan within that locker room. This is a team that is, it's sort of like a make or break year for this team at this point too, because they're finally healthy and they need to prove that this high tempo offense and to the masses, no real defense, even though we already covered why that was a misnomer, if this couldn't work. What happens throughout the season and postseason?
Well, the season goes really well. People forget because that's the year the Mavs had the best record, and so everyone's kind of very focused on what they did. We had a 15-game win streak in that season, and then 4 games later, we had a 17-game win streak.
Oh, was that the year that the Mavs played Phoenix in one of the greatest regular season games of all time? There was an unbelievable regular season game where it was Nash versus Dirk. And
I think so.
That game was amazing.
I'll tell you what year it was. It was the year that the Suns and the Nets played like this quadruple overtime game. Okay. And like Jason Kidd had like a quadruple double, and Steve Nash had like a damn near triple double. And it was like 161, 158, and everybody lost their mind. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, this is basketball nirvana. I think it was that year, but it's, honestly, a lot of times these things all blend together. So don't quote me.
But that top seeded Mavs team, that was a team that lost in the first round of the Warriors.
Yes,
right.
That's the We Believe Warriors. And that's also, by the way, one of our last games or maybe like a few weeks before the postseason, we were like, Don Nelson came in and talked to Steve in our locker room, and Steve said, Don Nelson, they want the Mavericks. They want to be the 8th seed. And this is like, oh, good luck. You know, we were like, what? Like, what do you guys think about it? They were very convinced that the Warriors were that, oh, we have their number inside and out.
I think outside of the lockout shortened season where the Knicks were the 8 playing the Miami Heat that were the 1, and the Knicks eventually had that upset, this was the 8 versus 1 that had the most national buzzes. An upset can really happen here. People that knew basketball was all about matchups, they really liked the Warriors' chances there. So the Mavericks, who are, in terms of seeding, the favorite to win in the Western Conference, they bow out early. What does this mean for you? I think Utah had a good team that year.
To us, it was all about San Antonio, to be honest. The Mavericks a little bit, yeah, obviously you got to respect them because they had the best record, and Dirk was amazing. But Dirk was MVP, I want to say, that year. But for us, it was always San Antonio. We knew San Antonio was the one that we would have to knock off, and everything else was kind of irrelevant but beyond that. By the way, like, you asked me what I remember that regular season. That was a team where everyone in the rotation either shot 38% from three or like 50% from the field. Legitimate. 8 players. Like,
that's crazy.
We annihilated teams. Like, and it wasn't even fair. Like, it was just, it was something else. It's like, it's when you know you're, something special is happening. And for me, especially because every team I'd worked with before that was like terrible. So now this is my first time being part of something good and everybody kind of working like not working on personal agendas, but like doing what they're supposed to do. So it was kind of crazy. But the other part of it is everybody was stressed. And Mike, I remember, did not like the Eyes on the Prize marketing campaign because he felt like this shit is stressful enough. I'm trying to keep everybody light, have fun. And we walk into work every day and they're just like, yo, you better win a title. That's basically what it said. And so, a lot of it was just kind of being irritated about things. Like they were irritated about a lot of things. Marcus Banks was a guy that signed in the off season, and then instantly realized like that wasn't the move for us, right?
Yeah. He was, Marcus Banks was one of those just, volume players that just needed a bunch of touches to get his.
Not only that, but also Marcus was, I won't call him a low energy player, but like he wasn't up tempo. He looked like he should be up tempo, but Marcus was a very much walk the ball up guy. And our game, our strategy is all about energy. Like
he was an early 2000s isolation basketball player that was just sort of odd man out, a bygone era. So tell me about, because the Spurs, you know how the Bulls had their Pistons, right? When they were coming, the Spurs were the Suns' Pistons. They needed to get over this hump. And unlike the Bulls, they were never able really to get over that hump.
Did. Yeah, we swept their ass. Like, anytime we got over that hump like a
But when'd you sweep them?
Like 2010.
Okay. But prior to that, you had your like heartbreaking losses.
Yes,
did you not?
A lot. Yes.
That's what, okay.
And,
so,
and Steve actually had more, by the way, because he had some with Dallas.
Because he had some with Dallas. So I forget 2010, because that's like the second, by then it's already the second incarnation of like the reshaped Phoenix Suns, right? At that point.
Yeah. I mean, it was a little different, but yeah, we were still kind of.
Okay. So I still want to think about like this core, but in terms of the postseason, I'm trying to highlight what happens on the bench in the postseason where Phoenix seems like they're finally going to get over the San Antonio hump, and it's ripped away by a very controversial referee decision where Amari Sotomayor comes off the bench. This is really, they were enforcing this law to the T. Doesn't really get involved. He just steps off the bench, but crosses some sort of threshold, and the NBA backs up this decision, and Amari Sotomayor ends up getting suspended, correct?
So does Boris Diaw, which I think we could have accepted, like Amari being suspended if Boris was there, because then you slide Boris to starting four, and that's when Boris wakes up from his slumber, like, oh, you need me now. And then he turns it to Magic Johnson again. But the fact that they took our two starting power forwards, or two starting top of power forwards, that was a gut punch for Robert Horry, who, by the way, was like a trick pony for them. Like, he comes in, he hits big shots, he does dirty things. But he's not like an essential part of their offense. And so our whole thing was like, none of those guys got up and fought. They got up to get a, because it was right by our bench, they got up to check on their teammate who like took a hard hit in their MVP. And the league was like, nope. Doesn't matter. There was an altercation. So actually in that game, in the first half, there was a play, or maybe early in that half, there was a play where, James Jones goes up and Francisco Elson completely like dirty, dirty play, like undercuts him, falls down hard. And, Tim Duncan and Bruce Bowen are on the bench and they both get up and they both step onto the floor. And so we said, here you go. If you're going to suspend our two guys, they need to be suspended too. Cause, you know, something happened and they came on the floor. And the league said no, because it wasn't quote unquote an altercation. It was just a flagrant foul or whatever.
Was this rule put into place after the Malice in the Palace?
No. This rule goes back to, the Sun, ironically, the Suns and the Knicks in like 93 had a fight. Have you ever seen the fight where Greg Anthony comes off the bench in an ugly shirt and sucker punches Kevin Johnson? That's where the rule came into place.
But, I just
want to say this real quick. They said it was an altercation. So he said, next time James Jones tell him if someone fouls you hard, punch him in the face. Because that's what you guys want an altercation in order to say those guys, or maybe you just recognize those guys weren't running a fight and so weren't our guys. But
again, you might as well, if you're going to serve the punishment, you might as well have gotten more for what you did. I remember feeling like it was very unfair. Most people did. It was strangely being letter of the law. I do recall that example of Tim Duncan doing it earlier as some of the public spin that the Phoenix Suns came out with at the time. But it seems as though this one decision absolutely nuked your chances in that series.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're talking about San Antonio, which is a team of champions, right? A great team. We had them beat, right? We should have beat them twice in Phoenix, but Steve got his eyes split open and him, or his nose split open, excuse me, and him coming in and out of the game gave them an opportunity to steal that win. We win game two, we lose game three, but then we win game four like, oh no, we really have them figured out now. And at that point, we're like, sayonara. like, we're about to put you to bed. And the suspensions happen and it takes out our momentum altogether. And they come in game five and we were leading for most of the game, but it was ugly because it's a ragtag group. And also if we play ugly, it plays into their hands and they win game five and then they go back home and they win game six. So it definitely killed our momentum, to say the least. And everyone knew, we knew like whoever wins this is going to win the championship because Utah was coming out the other bracket, side of the bracket. They weren't that good. And then the East was just like, whatever, we'll tee up whoever comes in there.
Yeah. The quite a bit of a difference in competition from the East to West back in those days. Okay. So the second round, the teams remaining are Phoenix, San Antonio, Utah, and Golden State. San Antonio beats you guys because of players coming off the bench. Another offseason of disappointment. What are you guys looking at in terms of how you retool for your next run? Or is there talk within the organization that we have to blow this up now because we blew our chance?
No, there wasn't a talk to blow it up. We're still very much, hey, we're a championship caliber team. We lost to the champs on some BS. So it's like, we're still there. But now Robert's running in with like, oh my God, this luxury tax bill is going to be out of control, right? And so Kurt Thomas has a big salary, but I think it's expiring. But it's like, he's the one that's got to move. And so now Steve Kerr is officially in charge and he goes from, this is pretty easy. The guy asked me for an advisor that I think we should take so-and-so, to now you're getting calls a million times a day at all hours of night. Why haven't you traded Kurt Thomas? Why haven't you traded Kurt Thomas? And it's, by the way, luxury tax is assessed on what your ending salary is in April of the following year. So it's July, or it's June, excuse me, like, or whatever, May, June. And Steve is getting harassed.
You got to get yourself an Ellisburg. I mean, the Miami Heat walked that all the way up to the deadline before they get under.
Yeah, exactly. But like, we didn't have that opportunity. Or I think if Steve had been a little bit more
seasoned,
he would have known, look, I could tell Robert, relax. Even if I don't have a plan right now, I can tell him relax because there's a lot of time. We can figure something out. Instead, we end up trading Kurt Thomas and 2 first-round picks. Not Kurt Thomas for 2 first-round picks. Kurt Thomas and 2 first-round picks to Oklahoma City, where Sam Presti, who is seasoned, even though this was his first go-around at being general manager, he's been in the front office for a while, is seasoned, and he senses the pressure Steve is under and throws him through the rails. He gives him exploding offers and all this stuff, and Steve, bends under pressure and does this terrible deal that we knew, like, the moment we did it, we knew it was terrible. And then, to make matters worse, Presti turned around and flipped Kurt Thomas to San Antonio for another first-round pick.
And I remember Kurt Thomas was a pretty decent player in terms of contributions.
Oh, no, this was a rotation player for us. This wasn't like just some dude at the end of the bench. And his salary wasn't crazy, but with a luxury tax, it was just oppressive, at least from Robert's perspective. So that's kind of...
So you guys don't do anything that offseason? You guys don't really do anything in the way of getting better?
The other thing was in the draft. Like, in the draft to 2007, we had a deal with Charlotte to move up to the top 10, and we thought we were going to take Joakim Noah. And so that was a fun thing for me going through that pre-draft workout circuit, in that we have all these players that are going to be available at like 27 and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden we have the Joakim Noah, Jeff Green, like Corey Brewer workout, which is, wait, how'd you guys swing that one? I was like, well, it started with Joakim Noah wanting to play for the Suns. And then he convinced the other two guys, you need to come work out for them, even though they don't have a pick. Cause top tier players don't work out for teams that don't have that pick.
So they asked, would they? It'd be a waste of time.
Exactly. Like, or worse, I'm giving you a free look at some of my flaws that you might hold against me later. But Joakim was really motivated to play for us. And so we went out there and we did this work. We had this workout and this interview process. And, Joakim Noah was probably one of the best pre-draft interviews we've ever had, as far as just like as advertised. Like, this guy's a winner, and you can tell the difference in him and every other prospect who's coming in. Like, this dude's a winner. Like, he knows what's important. He's about team. He's fiery. He wants to get better, all those things. And it just, like, Charlotte, I think, ended up doing the deal with Golden State to get Jason Richardson. And that's how we got out. Like, we're going to get their pick. We're going to give them 24 and 29, and they're going to give us 8 and a future first. And
so but that offseason, you're talking about the draft process, but those draft deals never actually go through. No. So you lose Kurt Thomas. Anybody else on that team that you guys lose headed into that regular season? And do you guys do anything in the way of addition?
Addition is going to probably be a strong no. I'm trying to think. Let me cheat here, like a basketball reference. I'm I'm pretty sure we didn't add anybody of note. Yeah, it was same. It was midway through that season we did the Shaq trade, but Grant Hill. Well, I'm sorry, Grant Hill. So Grant Hill. I'll leave you if we're gonna. Okay, so Grant Hill. This is funny. Grant Hill was in Orlando in 06-07, and I remember around January in our war room. Every war room has like whiteboards in there, like where you just write down stuff. And we started writing our projected starting lineup for next year was Steve, Raja, Grant Hill, Sean Marion, Amari Stoudemire. And I kept saying, well, like, how do we know? Because he's a free agent. And they were like, trust me, he's going to be. Like, that was, like, you would erase a lot of times, like, oh, we have a chance to get Kevin Garnett, which was another thing that we tried to do, like, before he went to Boston.
Yeah, you guys were close with Kevin Garnett. You guys that was a came deal. Really close.
That was a done deal.
That was a done deal. Deal. So tell me about the Kevin Garnett deal that never happened.
So Garnett wants out. And he wants to play for a championship, right? They finally convince him you need to come and play for a championship. So it's a three-way deal where Boston sends all the young guys and stuff to Minnesota. Minnesota sends us Garnett. And we send Sean Marion and like a couple other stuff to Boston. And so Danny says, if I trade for Sean Marion had an ETO. He had an option on his contract. He's like, I want him to lock in and then sign a two-year extension or a three-year extension on top of that, right? Which is $45 million for 3 years, $15 million a year. Sean Marion's agent, who's the late Dan Fagan, says, we're not taking a dime under max. Max at the time was probably about $18 million or 18 and some change. So Sean was basically saying, 15 is a pay cut. I'm not taking a pay cut. Even though we all felt like he wasn't going to get max on the open market. But yeah. Fagan is a guy who gets his client the most money. So he says to Danny, if you trade for Sean Marion without like giving him a max extension, he's going to walk. He's going to walk by the time this thing is in. He's going to opt out and he's out. Danny says, well, I'm not going to do this trade, give up all my young guys if I'm getting a guy who's going to walk after a year or 2 years or whatever. So the deal falls apart. But KG was supposed to be with the Suns. It was supposed to be, our lineup was supposed to be Steve Nash, Raja Bell, Grant Hill, Kevin Garnett, Amari Stoudemire. Oh, and the idea was that KG was going to fix everything about our defense. Like,
yeah,
we're middle of the road. KG was going to make us a top 10 defense. But still not compromise our offensive, you know, talents and what we're supposed to do.
And was Kevin Garnett himself excited about this through back channeling?
I saw, you know, back channeling. I saw Kevin Garnett at a party in, Vegas at All-Star Weekend 2007. And he was excited to be a part of the team.
Was Boston his plan B?
Boston, yeah. Well, Boston wasn't even a plan B because they didn't have, it was like, he was like, I'm not going to join a team that won 15 games.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like they were just bad. And so when our deal fell apart, Danny's like, hey, we're giving up all the stuff that you guys wanted anyway. And KG said no. And that's why they went and dealt their pick for Jeff Green, which was Jeff Green to Seattle for Ray Allen. And then they came back and like, how about now? Now we got two Hall of Famers. Okay. And so at that point, KG's like, okay, now I'm in. But originally, like the whole focus was how's it going to become a Phoenix Sun?
Fascinating case study and sliding doors. Plan A being Kobe Bryant, plan B working out, plan A being Phoenix for Kevin Garnett, plan B kind of working out, although disappointing when you consider the expectations, something Paul Pierce knows nothing about really, by just giving his comments publicly. So let's hit pause on this discussion and we'll talk about the signature Steve Kerr Phoenix trade, which is the acquisition of Shaquille O'Neal. It should be funny for our local hour audience too, because it might have been a case of trading problems for problems. We'll invoke Chris Quinn and trading staffs and it'll be fun. We'll talk all about Shaq and we'll get some Shaq stories from Amin El-Hassan next week on the local hour Wednesday. Again, good with you, Amin?
Yeah, sure, why not?
All right, we'll talk to you then.